Thank you, everyone. I'll start the last session because we're a little bit late already. This session, as you all know, is on product development partnerships, which are very different to, well, in many ways, are quite different to PPPs. So for those of you who don't know, I thought I'd give a quick one-minute explanation of what a PDP is. So a PDP is, it was a term developed, it's about making new pharmaceuticals. And PDPs are generally private, not-for-profit groups that are set up to make pharmaceuticals. They're generally funded philanthropically or by governments, and they work with academics or they work with companies. They may work with developing country manufacturers to make new products in areas of market failure. So that's an important point. It doesn't include normal pharmaceutical company activity in commercial areas. That PDPs are specifically set up to make pharmaceuticals in areas where there's not sufficient profit to encourage companies to do so. So with that understanding of PDPs, I'd just like to make a couple of two or three general points about PDPs and raise a couple of issues that I want you to sort of think about in terms of questions. So the first thing is, with PDPs, this is pharmaceutical development. So unlike all the things we heard about this morning, it doesn't happen in developing countries. And this is one of the hurdles to people funding it, or aid agencies funding it. So this activity generally happens in the West. That's where pharmaceutical companies are. So there's a little bit of activity in terms of you will do your clinical trials in a developing country, and you may have some developing country partners, but really the bulk of the activity happens in pharmaceutical companies or academic institutions in the West. And you see that with funding for neglected disease, development of neglected disease medicines, that we recently did a study of European funding. 66 cents in every euro is reinvested back into Europe. And that's a pretty common pattern because there isn't, there's only a very nascent pharmaceutical industry in the developing world. So it's hard for aid agencies to get their heads around the fact that they're going to be funding Western companies and or Western academic institutions, but at the end stages, it's always a company, and it's probably a Western company, and it's probably a company working in Philadelphia or, well, not in Sydney, but because we don't have an industry in Australia, but they're going to be working somewhere in the West, probably. And the second thing is that the whole issue about sustainability and graduating is absolutely not an issue here. These are areas of market failure. Buruli ulcer is never going to be a money spinner for a commercial drug company. Neither is leprosy, neither are a whole bunch of worm infections. No one's going to make money out of hookworm. So what we're talking about is areas that are, for the foreseeable future and probably forever, these are a public responsibility. So this means public or philanthropic funding. And where the private sector involvement is getting companies to provide their skill set. Now that's done really in one of two ways. Companies do not do this for profit, because there's no profits to be had. And that, surprisingly, is a key misunderstanding. A lot of people think, oh, I'll make enough profit to make this attractive to a company. But they have obviously never talked to a multinational drug company, because they're talking $5 billion. They're talking $5 billion. They're not talking $1 million or $2 million. When they're talking about profit, they mean really large sums of money, and much larger than the public would be willing or should put up. So this is pretty well all conducted on a not-for-profit basis, and what drug companies call it is the no-profit, no-loss model. All the multinational companies, that's the model they use, by which they mean our costs are covered, or because they're used to such big budgets, they actually mean a loss of less than $20 million a year, because that means essentially neutral. Small companies need full cost coverage, and they may even need a small return. And academics actually need full cost coverage as well. So what we're talking about is companies working on a no profit, no loss basis. And I think someone earlier was talking about that as well. So in this area, that is the norm. That said, there are benefits for private companies, and two kinds of private companies. For pharmaceutical companies themselves, there's not money in making a drug for malaria. But there may be, well, I shouldn't say there's none. There may be some modest Western sales, military, travellers, but it's pretty small beer compared to what they would get for an asthma drug or a hay fever drug. But what they will get, freedom to operate, is very important. corporate social responsibility is very important. Most of this activity, it's a little bit, someone mentioned Nestle earlier, it's a little bit like this. Most of this company activity started after the famous and dreadful South Africa court case. I don't know if you guys remember that. 40 multinational drug companies sued Nelson Mandela for trying to import AIDS drugs into Africa that the company wasn't marketing there themselves. It's called parallel importation. It was a complete PR disaster. We don't sue Nelson Mandela, who was, you know, practically God at that point. It looked terrible. They were suing him for trying to treat people who were dying from AIDS. You know, I don't know what they pay their PR reps, but I thought it was just a complete disaster. But the silver lining was that, well, there were two. One, they lost the court case. And two, they decided, well, we really need to have a rethink about how we operate in developing countries, which are not a market for us. But people are thinking about what we do there. And that's really what led to this increased interest in making not-for-profit products. So the benefits are, as I said, corporate social responsibility, freedom to operate, and also it's a long game. China, I don't know if you guys know, but China's just started to introduce health insurance. Now that is probably one of the things that's going to, it's a huge market changer. It's like finding, you know, the new, well, no, I won't get into it, but shale oil in America is probably changing the geopolitical balance. Well, private health insurance in China is the same kind of market changer. And China is already the third biggest pharma market in the world. That's mostly, a lot of that's generic products, but that's changing. And no one knows better than a pharma company where the emerging markets are. The whole of Latin America, a lot of Southeast Asia, China certainly, India certainly. And companies do work. There are domestic companies there, but they have a long way to go. Indian companies are the most ahead. Chinese companies are still, you know, Chinese drugs aren't up there yet. South Africa is quite behind. No one's even looking at Russia. So companies know that they still have those markets are theirs. So that's the background. It's quite different to the kind of things we talked about this morning, or agriculture or phones, where you have a local market and local consumers, because here you essentially have an activity outside developing countries, which is very important to the developing countries. So that said, there's two big issues that this raises, and they are that this is a very untraditional area for the public sector for development agencies, and it's also a very untraditional area for pharmaceutical companies. So in terms of the first, I felt a bit mean this morning. I spoke so harshly about WHO and about public health approaches. But what I was trying to say was there's obviously a place for public health approaches, and they're very important. But there's also places, there are things that aren't dealt with by that approach. So as an example, polio. The public health approach to polio used to be you provided iron lungs, you provided hospitals, you did capacity building in managing people for long-term care. That was the approach. You encouraged prevention of transmission and so on. But what's changed? That wasn't ever going to get rid of polio. What you needed for polio was a vaccine. So what I'm saying is there's a place for public health approaches, and there's a place where you need to innovate. You need to change the health paradigm. And product development should be focused on those places, and I think it is. Now, the problem for that is it's very different to how development agencies think. It's very high tech, it's very high risk, it's very high cost, it's long time frames, 80% of the things you invest in are going to fail, because that's the nature of the beast. It's not done in developing countries, there's pretty limited developing country engagement, it's an industrial process, so it doesn't look anything like what an aid worker thinks about. You can't go and stand beside an African person, because you're going to be standing beside someone at GlaxoSmithKline in Philadelphia much more likely than you're going to be standing beside a patient while this process happens. So from the point of view of aid agencies, it can be very confronting, these amounts of money to be given to this kind of industrial process. And then on the side of the companies, it's just as challenging. So these are very unfamiliar diseases to most companies. One of the guys from a big American company that shall be nameless said to me, I don't even know where half these countries are. You're saying, we need this product for malaria in Senegal or Cote d'Ivoire, or you list a whole bunch of countries, and he's like, I wouldn't know these countries if I fell over them. I don't know the diseases, I don't know the patients, I don't know the market, I'm not going to make any money. And the other thing is, even if you get all over all that, it's a very different market for companies to think about. This is all really high volume, low margin stuff. Now, drug companies don't work like that. Drug companies work on high margins and relatively low volumes. They don't try and address the whole world. So they may be quite comfortable with making an orphan drug for 100,000 people, but they'd be very uncomfortable about making a malaria drug for 100 million people with a tiny margin. They're often tender markets, they're public markets, the products are going to be purchased by multilaterals, Global Fund, Clinton Foundation, UNICEF. And then the nature of the market is that there's a kind of public management barrier in between the patient and the company. It's often not a direct sale for these kind of products. WHO may set the guidelines. There may be a purchasing agency, there may be an interim purchasing agency, and they may change the rules halfway through. So it's pretty common that you're in the middle of it takes 10 years to make a drug and about 15 for a vaccine. So you're 7 years into this process, you've taken a lot of risks and spent a lot of money, and then WHO will change the guidelines. And it's their role is to set the guidelines. But it's very difficult. It makes it very difficult for companies to think about this work. So with all that as context, that this is unfamiliar. Oh, I'm sorry, these questions were... Sorry, they were meant to go up after we'd said all this. So this is very unfamiliar for aid agencies. It's very unfamiliar for companies. And that's where groups like George's group come in. Product development partnerships are the bridge between those two groups wanting to do well in areas they're not familiar with. So I'll hand over to George, who's from the Medicines for Malaria Venture, which is one of the world's leading PDPs.
Good afternoon to you. Fall backwards. Good afternoon to you, hardy survivors. You get the endurance award. And unfortunately, I would like to dance through the ways drugs are developed the way that Michael danced through the way, but I won't have that same degree of entertainment. But I hope I can be brief in these comments, and then open up to my colleagues for discussion. Mary's covered a lot of the main points that I think are important to understand what PDPs do. We live in a space between donors that want to do the right thing about a large crisis of inadequate drugs today, but they're not sure how to begin placing correct bets on a very expensive proposition, which is how do you do targeted drug development for neglected diseases? And then you've already talked a bit about industry's worries about getting into low-margin products. What I hope to show you in the next few slides is where PDPs evolved out of this great vacuum, which was a machine that knows how to make drugs, donors and governments that were asking for them, but it was hard to actually get people into this low margin, non-profitable space. Let's see if this works. Malaria, most of you in this room will have some familiarity with it. It's one of the most devastating and lethal infectious diseases. We think of the worst death rates being in Africa, and unfortunately that's mainly 85% in children. It's a large global public health problem, not just African. Did I jump to anything? No, okay. So MMV, this is a snapshot of what we call a classic drug development pipeline. From left to right, you see products that are either being examined in their early stages, pre-human, being tested in for safety, early safety in man, not even efficacy. Is it safe and efficacious in man, phase two? And then if it really is ready to be tested large scale, it goes into what's called phase three trials, involving thousands of patients. This is very typical for any drug company, except you don't see many organizations with a full suite of drugs pre and post, pre and intrahuman testing being developed just for malaria. MMV, in essence, this is a snapshot of what the last 13 years of work have done, is created a filled space where literally in the early 1990s, there was nothing coming through any pharma company's pipeline. So that's sort of a snapshot of what a PDP can do if it's properly set up and structured and funded for 15 years. I want to tell you a little bit about the evolution of our model, and I think it speaks to many of the drug development partnerships. So when we're talking about the lack of innovation that's out there for neglected diseases, the lack of innovation in drugs, the problem is this. Government on its own is not normally in the position of seeking one-on-one collaboration with industry in the pharmaceutical space for the development of new products. There's a number of good reasons why. Governments traditionally focus on regulating drug safety, not on stimulating and trying to incentivize new drug development. There are some exceptions. They can give orphan drug status. They can create voucher schemes. But these are fairly new concepts. Historically, government hasn't seen industry as a partner, but rather, I'm the guy who watches out what you guys in industry are doing to make sure that my people are safe with the products you bring out. It's almost been an antagonistic or relationship of not, let's say, collaborative trust. Flip over to the industry folks. Pharmaceutical industry has a whole other series of incentives that make them get out of bed in the morning. First of all, they're accountable, by and large, to their investors. Investors are seeking profits. Growth is key. You lose your job as a CEO if you're not guaranteeing growth. And growth, as you pointed out, is high margin, relatively low volume products. They also look to innovate in drugs where they're guaranteed many years of protection of those drugs that they innovate. Intellectual property laws are critical for the pharmaceutical companies. So they don't want to be involved in what I would call public good products. They don't want to be told, you're going to help develop a product that in 2 years will have 7 generic competitors. Why would they do that then? There goes all their future 7 to 10 years of monopolistic pricing. And lastly, when a drug company looks at something like a neglected disease space, they normally don't like to jump in early on. What a big pharma will do often is wait till a small biotech or university has done the initial screening of products before they would jump in and take it to a large phase 3. So if a government knocks on a pharma guy's door and says, we'd like you to help us do some early stage discovery on a disease that has no profit, they would say, not right on the money side, and not right on the development side. So what PDPs are doing is filling this gap. And quickly, I think we've already covered a lot of these concepts. A PDP like MMV is combining drug development experience. We have 35 professionals from industry who've come into the PDP space. People should know what they're doing within a PDP. Be industry proven, but have a different focus, let's say, for the rest of their career. We have deep disease knowledge about malaria. Arguably today, with 35 people, 35 scientists focused on malaria, we are more in-depth knowledge about malaria than any pharmaceutical company in the world, because they don't normally have a 35-man or 35-woman department focused on malaria research. I talked earlier today about de-risking, and we de-risk for pharmaceutical companies because by the time a pharma company agrees to partner with MMV, our teams have already done a lot of pre-screening on viable candidates. In other words, pharma company, you're not on your own. You're partnering with a group that already has been doing a lot of investigation on likely targets. A PDP is also ensuring the donors that their monies will be used appropriately with a target product profile that matches the public health need. Let me move on, because I think I'm going to address the other issues here further on. So the way we think of MMV as a drug development partnership is between the pharma industry that has a lot of drug development know-how, large manufacturing capacity, supply chain, and in your public sector, you have donors who are interested in the global scope, the global health impact. They're trusted to be driving the public health needs. They do have money to put towards this. But to Mary's points earlier, with all due love, they're perceived as slow moving, and they're not necessarily driving these agendas on the speed that pharmaceutical companies like to turn them around, which is in 3 to 5 year windows. MMV falls into this space as a PDP with know-how, an entrepreneurial bent, scientific bench strength, and the trust of donors and partners. Some key attributes of the model that lay behind that big, huge drug development pipeline that you saw. So, when a donor comes to us wanting to look at malaria drugs, we have a portfolio approach. Within those 50 micro projects that you couldn't see the fine details on, any one of those can fail. As Mary pointed out, you start with a molecule, it has an 80% chance of not getting to the end of the road. The portfolio approach that a PDP controls means that you're moving several projects forward at the same time. You expect some of these soldiers to die, but you're moving forward multiple partner projects at the same time. We have significant scientific autonomy. So this sounds bad, but you've all heard different stories in the pharmaceutical industry of a sheltered product probably should have been shelved. A company has one bet on it. It keeps moving the product through the pharmaceutical development process because the economic burden, the economic bet is too high to let it fail. In other words, unhealthy products are put through to late stages and sometimes put into the market. I'm not saying they're unsafe, but they're not always effective or as effective as they could be. MMV has no wedded economic tie to the success of these projects. If they don't work, we kill them, and we kill them early. And lastly, in our model, the farmer contribution model, as I pointed out earlier, is they do have research strength that we channel. GSK has a center in Madrid that we pretty much took over a whole part of to use their scientists, train them up on malaria, and make this a de facto in-kind contribution by GSK. We do this with all of our partners, Novartis, Sanofi. We leverage our team and their in-house capabilities. And I've already talked about their manufacturing capabilities to do hundreds of millions of treatments a year, if need be. When a pharma partner comes into an agreement with MMV, they have to agree to our target product profile. The drug can be priced only at a certain level. The adult target will be $1, $1.50. The pediatric will be 37.50 cents. They can't turn around and say, thanks for being with us for the past 5 years, MMV. We're now going to sell that drug for $25. If they come to partner with us, they're locked into the target product profile, including price responsibility. And lastly, there's a small part I haven't talked about, which is actually the area I work in. On the access side, MMV has a small cluster of people who, once a drug is approved, the EMA, the WHO has pre-qualified it. Our team actually works with the partners who are ensuring uptake in countries. That includes the WHO, Rollback Malaria Partnership, and also partners that are trying to expand the reach of drugs into countries in places they're not normally going. So the case study, this is really fairly brief. I want to describe how the earliest drug that we got through the pipeline with Novartis was developed. WHO, as late as 2008, was saying, why is it that even though we have some good drugs for malaria at this point, we're still not addressing that 85% of the population that dies from malaria? Why is it that we have no good pediatric formulations, nothing in a fixed dose combination? So instead of three loose pills, a single pill for children, a simple regimen, something that's easy to understand, and that if a mom in the village doesn't have a lot of healthcare support, the label and the packaging explains to anyone out there, here's how you use the drug for your children. MMV signed a partnership agreement with Novartis 2003, 6 years before the product came to market. This is a classic lead time, 5 to 6 years of drug development collaboration with Novartis. We agreed that we would work on a dispersible, which is a, you'll see in the photographs, a pill that dissolves in water, easily taken by children. And SwissMedic had approved a crushed tablet version of the adult pill. What we had to do for the next 5 years was say, the adult formulation when crushed is bioequivalent to a child-friendly that dissolves in water. And that, in essence, was the scientific challenge of what we agreed to. Here's the CEO of Novartis shaking hands with the CEO of MNB. Significant, because later I'm going to point out to you why a visionary commitment from the top can make these partnerships work a lot better. I'm not going to read you through the full phase one, phase two, phase three, but this is just to highlight for those of you who know drug development that we had to, in essence, recreate a full drug development process for the pediatric presentation. After 5 years of working with Novartis, we ended up with the target product as we wanted it, a pill dropped in water. Within 10 seconds of swirling, becomes a sweet tasting, cherry smelling product that children would very readily take. I don't have the video of what children used to do with an adult crush tablet, but more often than not, they would spit it out or fight desperately not to swallow it. This became a flavor mass formulation that, while it seems obvious to those of us who have the benefit of giving our children child-friendly medicines, African malaria patients had never had this. The one thing I was talking about, making sure it's easy for people to use, this is just a quick snapshot of how, after much field testing, the packaging, the healthcare worker instruction booklets that went along with it were really tailored to the end user segment. And lastly, in the subsequent 4 years since that product was launched in 2009, there's several areas in which we've continued to support its expanded use. The first time use of this product by community health workers in Malawi. Tracking the product's availability in rural Tanzania through an innovative SMS for Life project that we've done with Novartis. Lots of advocacy. Now that the drug is there, we're advocating for policy change in line with WHO. And lastly, looking at parts of Africa where there's still cultural preferences for formulations that really aren't appropriate for children. It's not about pushing this drug, it's about saying, why would you still use non-quality formulations if you have a whole suite of upcoming formulations that can work better? And trying to analyze those barriers to acceptance. Here's the last slide about what Coartem Dispersible has done. In the last 4 years, it's gone from basically zero up to over 140 million treatments delivered in the past 3.5 years. It's now 100% of all the child weight formulation that Novartis sells. And at those kind of volumes, it represents probably 60% of all the artemisinin and combination drugs that Novartis sells. It's the second most important drug today in Africa. So, my last slide talks about disclaimers. This makes it sound like 5 years of hard work, within 3 years, hundreds of millions of patients are getting the drug. It's not always so easy. So these are the disclaimers about why this was a relatively fast home run. Number one, Novartis was already committed to being in this space. So when you have Dan Vasella, the chairman and CEO, shaking hands with the PDP, you know that all the soldiers inside that organization are lined up behind this project. That makes it go fast. That's a great place to be. It's not always that easy. The scientific hurdle was high, but not that high. They had an existing drug. It was an adult presentation, and we had to help them make a pediatric extension. Again, if it's a completely new chemical entity, the scientific hurdles can be higher. And lastly, the acceptance hurdle, those 140 million treatments have gone into countries that by and large already knew the adult formulation. So if no one had ever seen this drug in any presentation whatsoever, it probably would have been a harder introduction. And lastly, a comment about the characteristics of our partners. So not everyone that we work with, some smaller family-run companies, have this track record in the neglected disease space. The CEO-level commitment's not always there. This global footprint, Novartis aspires to be, as you were saying, in Asia, in Africa, in Latin America, in Europe. Novartis has a global marketing machine, and that can work in your favor when they're trying to get countries using new drugs. Promotion isn't always a bad thing, but not all the partners we work with have that global footprint. And lastly, Novartis has dedicated a facility in New York that cranks out 100 million tablets, treatments, actually closer to 900 million tablets per year. Very few pharma companies can take that capital expenditure and put a whole factory just for a single malaria drug. Novartis was able to absorb that kind of commitment. So, to disclaimer because I don't want to make it sound like it's a snap of a finger. And I'd like to leave open for comments now.
Thank you. Oh, thank you, George. That was wonderful. It's much harder than, as you said. But just to put PDPs in perspective, they've been around since just before 2000, really. And in terms of their track record, we've had over 40 new products registered for neglected diseases, and about 40% of those have come from PDPs. That's remarkable. I mean, I was working with MSF when we'd had, I think the record was 13 new products in the previous 25 years. And we were desperate for proper treatments. So some of those new products include the first meningitis vaccine for Africa. There were no meningitis cases in the three African countries it was rolled out in last year. That's in the meningitis belt. That was a real first. As you said, the first malaria medicine for children. You know, 85% of people dying from a disease are children. And in all these years, we've never had a medicine to give children. And I don't know which of you have small babies, but trying to give a baby a syrup is quite hard work. So there's been over 40 treatments made, and there's now over 350 candidate products in the pipeline. Not a lot of those will fail, as we've all said, but that's remarkable. So that's over 350 candidates, and there's now over $3 billion a year invested into these non-for-profit, development of not-for-profit pharmaceuticals, with Australia has announced that it will be making a commitment to join funding of that effort. And it is a little bit of money at the start, but it's a toe in the water and we're very pleased to see it. But what I'd like to do now is hand over to Wayne. Wayne Best, well, you've read his bio, no doubt, but he represents a small company here in Australia who works with another PDP, the Drugs for Neglected Diseases Initiative. So Wayne, can I hand over to you? Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. Yes, my company, EpiChem, we're a small private company, 15 people, based in Perth, Western Australia, so we're local, as it were. We've been working with a PDP for 6 years now. That particular PDP is Drugs for Neglected Diseases Initiative. And I guess we got involved with them because of our interest in antiparasitic drugs. We're based on the campus of Murdoch University, and Murdoch University has a very strong history in parasitology. And we happen to have a long-standing collaboration with a parasitologist there. And so we'd had some quite interesting compounds that had activity against a range of parasites. And it occurred to us that one of the parasites that it may be able to treat was African sleeping sickness. And so we looked around to try and find a way of progressing this potential treatment for African sleeping sickness. And we looked at various granting bodies and looked at the ARC and other types of granting bodies within Australia. And while those kind of granting bodies are very good for early stage discovery chemistry, for discovering these kind of compounds, when you want to translate that discovery into an effective product on the marketplace, there's very little funding at all for that kind of translational research within the system. And particularly being a neglected disease, there was also no mechanism by which we could progress that compound commercially either. So we started looking at other sources of funding, and one of those was WHO TDR, and they were quite excited by the compounds we had and were keen to fund it. However, for some reason, after about a year of toing and froing, I think there was a change of personnel at TDR, and that whole thing kind of disintegrated. And so at that point, we'd kind of almost given up on this particular project. But then fortunately, somebody introduced us to the NDI in 2006. And within a very short space of time, they'd committed to fund that project. And in return for them funding the project, they would get, or we would grant them royalty-free rights to use that, whatever came out of that project, in the developing world for neglected diseases. and we would be able to maintain the rights to use that compound in the developed world and also for animal health products. So it was a bit of a win-win. That project went on for 2 years, and it was relatively successful in that by the end of that period, we'd developed compounds that cured African sleeping sickness in a validated mouse model, and they were quite safe. And it probably would have been progressed further, but during that period, DNDi had actually acquired an even better compound from a US-based biotech company, and that drug now is in clinical trials. So it's one of many of the compounds that DNDi have got going through their pipeline at the moment. So the story, I guess, could have ended there, but I guess we had developed a relationship with DNDi. They were very happy with the sort of quality of the work we did, and we were very happy working for them. And so at that point, they had a big program in a very closely related disease called Chagas disease, which is caused by a very similar parasite. And so because we'd had the chemistry all set up, and because our colleagues at Murdoch University had the right parasites to do that kind of program, they contracted us to form a Chagas disease consortium, I guess, which consisted of ourselves, Murdoch University, and also a group at Monash University called the Centre for Drug Candidate Optimisation, which is a highly respected unit here in Australia. So what we had, EpiChem brings chemistry to the table, Murdoch brings biology to the table, and the CDCO brings pharmacology to the table. And I guess one of the things that highlights is that drug discovery is a very multidiscipline sort of subject. No one organisation has all the skills really to be able to take a drug from discovery right through and to the end user. So I guess we've been working with them now for the last 4 years or so on a different sort of model. I mean, the first 2 years we were kind of a partner in the sense that we had a share of the intellectual property, we had a share of what they were developing, whereas now we're essentially just a contract supplier. We provide the chemistry for them, and we don't have any stake in the IP. So all the IP that comes out of that project now is owned by DNDi. Somebody raised the question early this morning, I think, is, you know, how effective are these PDPs, you know? And I'd just like to say unequivocally that they are extremely effective. EpiChem is a contract lab, as I mentioned, and we work with a number of other companies, right through from big pharmaceutical companies to mid-tier biotech companies, right through to spin-outs from universities and very early stage companies. And I think we'd have to say that DNDi has been one of the most effective companies we've seen at pushing compounds through pipelines. And they've got quite a varied pipeline as well. It's not just African sleeping sickness, there's Chagas disease, leishmaniasis, HIV now, I think, and a number of other areas they're working on. Certainly, when we first got involved with them, I just imagined that DNDi was like a funding body, as it were. They would just give us money and we'd go away and do our bit. Fortunately, I was quite wrong. They turned out to be very similar to MMV, George, where they're a collection of really highly qualified experts in their own field, and DNDi was able to provide not just, you know, extremely good project management, but they brought expertise to the table that we could never have dreamed of accessing ourselves. The network that they have with pharmaceutical companies and suppliers throughout the globe is fantastic. And if there's something we need to help with the project that we can't access ourselves, DNDi is always there to quickly provide that from another supplier. So I guess from that point of view, there's no doubt in our mind that the model is extremely extremely valuable. And I don't think any of these, certainly our project would have just languished. There was no mechanism by which we could get that translational part of the project happening without the PDP. And I'm not sure where, if it wasn't for PDPs, where those drugs would come from or what model would be used. I haven't seen any other really effective model. The PDPs like DNDi have been incredibly successful at, I think, filling funds for that gap in translational research, not just for us, but for a number of other organisations. I see them going around essentially hoovering up all these wonderful bits of discovery. that have been lying around for quite some time that have languished because of lack of funds. Now the PDPs are getting involved, and there's all these discoveries that have been made over the last 20 years that are coming out of the woodwork, and they're being developed through the funds that the PDPs provide, not just the funds but the expertise. So I'm obviously a great supporter of PDPs. My only concern, I guess, would be that their success could be their own downfall. Now that they've been proven to be successful, people want to give them money. And I guess I'm concerned that with all the money that people want to donate to them, that some of that donation might come with strings attached and extra layers of bureaucracy. And one of the things that I've found about certainly working with DNDI is that they've been very effective and very successful because they're so dynamic and so flexible, unlike a lot of the other organisations you get out there. And it's that flexibility and able to make decisions quickly, I think, that's been at the heart of their success. You know, we have lots of... We don't talk with bureaucrats. There's no discussion between EpiChem and DNDI in terms of bureaucracy. That probably occupies 0.1% of our time. Need a contract signed, the contract gets signed very, very quickly. Wayne, all the dialogue we have is scientist to scientist.
I'm sorry, we started late, yeah. So we've only got a little bit left. Gabrielle.
Thank you, Marion. This will be a challenge for both you and for me, being the last speaker in the last session, but I shall try to be brief. The other challenge is that although the examples discussed here are drug development in the human health field, the expertise I bring to the table actually relates to livestock health. And some of you would be familiar that indeed some of the diseases in Africa particularly move from wildlife, from livestock to people, including trypanosomiasis, which Wayne has just been discussing. But I'm involved with a group in Nairobi actually over the last decade, and we've been actually addressing some of these issues in a different way, and that is to look at dealing with some of the livestock diseases in Africa and by African scientists. And so there has been a new research facility built in Nairobi with support from the Canadian government to actually enable the new life sciences to be able to be used to address problems in African agriculture, including livestock health. And this builds on an institute called the International Livestock Research Institute, which indeed has spent about 30 years working on trypanosomiasis. So some of these issues take a very long time to be resolved. And I think Wayne's examples of new products are extremely exciting. But what I wanted to touch on extremely briefly is a new business model that we're looking at for development and delivery of livestock disease vaccines. And this has a number of interesting features of public-private sector partnerships. The first is what you would call, I think, in this forum, the early stage discovery work for a new vaccine against a disease called PPR. It's a virus disease important for sheep and goats across large areas of the Sahel and the Horn of Africa. And the early stage discovery of developing a thermostable vaccine, which means ones you can keep in a shelf at 37 degrees for a month, that's actually been done through a partnership between AusAid, CSIRO, the International Institute, and the Regional African Platform in Nairobi. And so that's now through proof of concept, and we're looking at the rollout for pilot scale inoculations in a number of countries, but then looking at to develop the larger scale rollout. And that involves actually private sector players at each step along the chain. But interestingly, it doesn't involve the big pharma companies, who are not really terribly interested in a disease that kills 100 million sheep and goats. Really, they can't make money on malaria. It's extremely unlikely they'll be making any money at all on a disease of sheep and goats in the Sahel. But that's not to say that private sector players cannot turn this into a business. And so the steps along the chain now are to look for partners for the vaccine manufacturer, to look at the quality control to produce an effective vaccine. There are local vaccine manufacturers in Kenya, in Ethiopia, Zambia, and the role of government there is to ensure the registration and the continued quality of the vaccine. Mary asked me to mention a few failures. one of the biggest failures of vaccines in livestock health in Africa, a country that shall better be nameless, actually manufactured the vaccine for foot and mouth disease. And that, unfortunately, there was a quality breakdown, and what was actually distributed was live foot and mouth virus. This was not terribly helpful, and so it engaged a considerable shake-up on the quality of vaccine manufacture across several countries of Africa. And part of the public sector investment, including development investment, can be through advanced market commitments, so to actually guarantee the purchase of a certain number of doses of the vaccine. And then that needs to go into distribution chains. And again, working with local businesses who provide veterinary services, sell seeds, sell small amounts of drugs for livestock. And then the issue becomes also of linking with microcredit, both for the suppliers, but also ultimately for the consumers. And linking back to this morning's effort about in Cambodia with Wing, there's an equivalent in Kenya for mobile phone banking, which is called M-Pesa. And now that's not only used for banking, it's also used for selling microinsurance, both for crops and for livestock. So now some of the pastoralists up in the Horn of Africa, in the Kenyan side at least, can insure every sheep, goat, camel and cow that they own through their M-Pesa account. And then if the rains fail, they're paid back, which enables them either to buy extra feed for their livestock, to sell the livestock and restock after the drought. And one of the opportunities we're looking at here is also to use M-Pesa and microcredit to actually provide credit to buy vaccines to protect the livestock for animal health issues. And I think finally at lunchtime somebody said to me, well, really, none of these public-private sector partnerships actually work. You know, they just need continual public funding to be sustained. What do you think is a really key factor? So since the spring racing carnival is almost upon us, I thought I'd use Paul Keating's famous phrase, which says, in any partnership, always back self-interest, because at least you know he'll be trying. Thank you.